First, a program note. The following podcast includes adult situations and language.
How you doing, Mr. Little?
How you doing, sir?
I'm not doing.
You're not doing?
What's talking about?
Well, we'll talk about it right now.
I'm a kingpin.
We just
deal. I'm gonna sue somebody.
Well, just don't sue us. We just came to holler at you.
I'm responsible for accused of me being a kingpin. They have my name
on.
Yeah, what? All over television.
Kingpin.
Yeah, dope killer.
No.
That's what the classification lady just told me. The classification people just told me that they have me on television, living us dope killer cross country. From Texas to all over the country, big time dope dealer, kingpin.
No, that's not
my
true.
My face is all over the dime. Okay.
Well, we had nothing to do with that.
I'll turn the news later and see what's on there. Nobody told us.
Well, we just came to holler at you for a little bit. We're detectives. My partner, Detective Antonucci, and I'm Detective Amador. We're out of L.A. Now, do you know why you're here?
Where?
Los Angeles.
Well.
We flew all the way from LA to come see you.
For what?
Well, do you know why you're here?
Sam Little is finally where that Los Angeles Police Department wants him, under arrest and in jail. Two detectives flew from Los Angeles to Louisville, Kentucky for a sit-down with the suspected serial killer in 2012. Over a life of crime that had spanned five decades, Little was no rookie when it came to police interrogations. He had been there before and knew when to talk and when not to talk. He would be a formidable adversary in what would be one of the key moments in the case. We're going to listen to the interview and analyze what was said and not said in this episode of The Women Who Stopped Sam Little. I'm Michael Connolly, and you are listening to Murder Book.
Mr. Little, I gotta
say,
you gotta remember.
I know.
Yeah, I remember all my ladies I've been with.
Yeah, you've been around. You've lived a very interesting life.
Because I just been in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right, right.
Okay, let me set the stage here if I can. LAPD cold case detective Mitzi Roberts caught a career case in 2012 when the murders of two women back in 1989 were connected by DNA. Further testing of that DNA identified a suspect named Sam Little, a drifter with an arrest record in 24 states, a drifter who had been charged with murder in the past and other violent crimes against women, but had served little or no time. Roberts tracked Little across the country and finally located him in Louisville, Kentucky, and arranged for his arrest. He was taken into custody on an old drug charge as part of a strategy to keep him from knowing that the murder net was finally closing in around him. While Roberts continued to build the case in Los Angeles, her partner, Rod Amador, and another cold case detective named Sue Antonucci were immediately dispatched to Kentucky for a face-to-face with Sam Little. Now, remember, the district attorney's office said the DNA match between Little and the victims was not enough. The victims were dwellers on the fringes of society. They were drug users and involved in risky lifestyles, opening the door for the DNA match to be explained. The DA told the detectives to make the case better, and this was their chance. Amador and Antonucci went to Kentucky to get a confession, barring that, a self-incriminating admission. Or deception that could be proved by the facts of the case. At the very least, they wanted information that would help the investigation. Here's Detective Roberts.
In the reports that I had read prior, he had always talked to the police, but it was obvious that he always threw his sort of flim-flam. He was always trying to get one over on the investigators and make himself look like there was no possible way that he could be the guy that was responsible for what they were investigating. But he always did talk to the police. And sometimes, especially when he was angry, he would say stupid stuff. So I was kind of hoping that maybe he would slip up and at least say something that would help us further the investigation into him being a serial killer.
We have an exclusive recording of that interview, but before we get to it, let's hear from Detective Amador about his thinking as he and Antonucci were going into that jail in Louisville to meet Sam Little.
You know, first and foremost, we had a solid case as far as DNA evidence against this guy. We had two solid cases, you know, due to the good work that we did. And, you know, you want to bring closure to these two ladies, you know, have closure and have justice for them as well as their families. That was like, for me, that was the main purpose. But looking into his bio and his history and where he's been and all that, you know, I did not want to go up there with the typical two swinging dicks from LAPD up there and kind of being hardcore with this guy. Because dealing with guys that in the past on my job, obviously, and where I grew up, I grew up in housing projects, and I remember seeing guys, you know, I couldn't say they were murderers, but they were con artists, they were scam artists. They played a lot on women, either psychologically, you know, financially. So I knew because of his background, he was going to probably not talk to us about the murders and close up. He's been around, he's been in the joint. So I looked at that. So I wanted to have maybe like a softer approach. I wanted to take a female detective with me. And in doing so, I took Sue Antonucci, who very accomplished. She's very sharp. And looking at Mr. Little's background, I'm thinking, okay, do you want to be locked up in a cell at the marshal's office and probably cold in there? Or do you want to come out and talk and shoot the breeze with a couple of LA detectives, you know, and now why not have a female there? Maybe he would open up to us a little more. So that was my initial approach. And it worked out pretty good. Just as soon as I walked in, I saw this guy and I said, okay, this guy has a big ego. He's going to want to talk about what he's done in life and kind of boost himself up. But at the same time, I knew if we were to pressure him right off the bat on these two ladies that we were looking at, he was going to shut down. So we just started. I wanted him to talk about basically his life, where he's been, all the locations that he's been to, where he lived, who he lived with, the cars he was driving. So that at least if we didn't get a confession from the guy, we were going to have him at each place in which he committed murders or could have committed murders, so that the prosecution side of it, as far as the DA and all that, and when we finally took him to court, that we would have that on record, that at least he's been to these locations. And I think it would have been easier for the DA to pinpoint him as to him being at these locations, as opposed to us doing legwork, which is going to take a lot more time. At least to get him to open up of all the places he's been to, he visited, he lived in, the places where he did time in. And lo and behold, he just started, you know, talking, and we just allowed him to talk. And I think that was my initial plan, along with my partner at the time, Sue Antonucci, who's got a great personality and, you know, is a great detective. And he just started talking to us, and that's what we wanted him to do.
The detectives talked with Little for more than an hour, and I look at the interview as having two parts. Part one is the getting to know you phase, where the detectives played to Sam Little's ego, and he opened up and revealed without hesitation his life travels, seemingly never tipping to the reason why these two detectives might have come all the way from L.A. to talk to him. We're going to move past the preamble, if you will, and get to the parts where Little was providing very useful information. In a way, he was giving them a roadmap of his life. You're going to have to listen hard because while the recording is good, Sam Little has a tendency to mumble.
You know, you have a very interesting past. You've traveled a lot.
Yeah.
And you've been at shelters. And did you ever have a home? Did you ever, a place where you considered your home?
Well, I own the Coconut Grove.
A Coconut Grove?
I was in a home in Tallahassee. The place I lived was in Lorain. I left Lorain when my grandma died. I moved on to Miami with my mother.
Uh-huh. How old were you?
I was 26 when I moved on there.
36?
26.
26. Did you ever go in the military after that or during that?
No, I've been out of penitentiary.
For what?
Shoplifting, petty thefts.
And what?
Shoplifting, petty thefts.
Okay. So after you were in Tallahassee, where'd you go after that?
Well, Tallahassee, I traveled around to back east.
The east, back east?
Mm-hmm.
Where back east?
Back to, Tennessee. I stayed in Hopkins, Tennessee, and stayed in Shelby, Nashville. Then I went on up to Ohio, back to Columbus, Ohio.
Uh-huh. Did you ever work? Did you ever have a trade? Did you?
Yeah, I worked at U.S. Steel. I worked at Dade County Sanitation Department.
When was that? Is that in your 20s, in your 30s?
Yes.
And how long did you do that for?
Well, I worked in Dade County Sanitation Department about 6 months. I worked in Charles Davis Cemetery down there for about a month. But most of my work was on USS Steel in Lorain, Ohio.
Right.
And
what'd you do after doing steel work?
I went to Miami. Like I said, I worked there at 65, went to Miami.
Miami? What'd you do in Miami?
I worked at Dade County Sanitation Department, Starr Davis Cemetery. I worked at...
So you're a man of all trades.
Well, I'm an artist, too. I worked on drawing pictures.
Really? Did you ever exhibit any of that stuff, or you just... It was like a hobby to you, or...?
No, Captain Green down at the county jail, in Dade County Jail, had me do some portraits for the walls in the county. I was on newspaper and stuff there for doing something. He was trying to help me get started.
Oh, sure.
But I never did get started, because my old lady she was a booster, shoplifter, and I traveled, she had got in trouble on that, so I took it, and they were going to put in a hole for the phone. So instead of me getting established, we went to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I had to follow with her, because she shoplifters, and that's how we lived.
That's how we lived. Little openly talked about crossing the country with a woman named Jean. Police would later identify her as Aurelia Dorsey. They supported themselves by shoplifting and then selling the stolen goods. He mentioned 24 different cities during the first part of the interview, and he was not shy about telling the detectives about his transportation. We'll continue with Sam Little's interview right after this. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by the Hachette Book Group, publishers of my books and also publishers of Ian Rankin. And that's who I want to talk about today. Rankin is one of today's true masters. His long-running character, John Rebus, is iconic in the field of crime fiction. The books have won just about every award out there. And when I say long-running, I mean for more than 30 years, Rebus has been cutting a unique path through the pages of crime fiction. And I've been writing and reading along with him all the way. His new book is called A Song for the Dark Times, and I got an early look at it, and it's great. It starts with a call in the dead of night from Rebus's daughter, who tells him her husband has gone missing. Fearing the worst, Rebus, of course, gets in his car and drives out towards the windswept Scottish coast and a small town with big secrets. The whole way, he's wondering if this is the first time in his life where the truth is the one thing he doesn't want to find. So, read A Song for the Dark Times, a thrilling new Inspector Rebus novel from the best-selling Edgar Award-winning author Ian Rankin. Available now in hardcover, ebook, and audio wherever books are sold. Now back to the podcast. Now back to the LAPD's first interview with Sam Little.
Do you have any cars?
Well, I had a Buick, but they took it on my way back up from Tucson.
Okay.
I told them for driving suspension.
What kind of car was it?
It's a Buick Park Avenue.
But it was?
It's 95 Park Avenue Buick.
What color?
It was a burgundy.
Was it registered to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. From Arizona?
No, I got to Jackson, Mississippi, where I got the place registered at.
Okay. And where did they take the car, though?
It was coming from California, and I got stopped in Tucson making a U turn, and they took it for driving a suspended license.
Suspended license?
And I was had a warrant for shoplifting down there.
Okay.
What year was that?
95?
No, that was that's the year to cover.
Yeah. Oh, right, okay. Yeah. What year did they take the car?
This year.
This year? Yeah. Okay. Were you on your way here?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was a couple months ago or
yeah,
last
couple
month?
Months ago.
Okay, so we're
like
July?
June, July?
Yeah. About June.
And how long have you been here in Louisville?
It's going about 2 months.
For 2 months?
Sam would mention six other cars he used over the years, and these details were just as important as the locations where he had been.
But he used a lot of cars, so that was very important for him to talk about those cars, because now he owns them. And if this ever went through a jury trial, how was he going to say, well, I never owned that car, and we have him on tape saying, yeah, I own that car during these dates, and I drove them, these vehicles in these cities. So I don't have the specifics with me because it's been a long time, but yeah, I remember the importance of the cars was very, very vital as well as the cities he lived in and the areas he lived in within those cities where he could have quick access to.
Right.
Like in LA, in South Central, he said he lived there for a while and two of our victims were lived in the area. So he got to talk about that. So our focus was to focus on our two victims and try to get us more information, the most information we can get on those two victims for further prosecution.
Amador said it was a rare thing in his career to have someone in a jailhouse interview open up the way Sam Little did.
He just rambled on and on and on, and we're taking notes, and we're just letting him talk. I don't know if you listen to the recording, we don't really ask him too much. Just little stuff like, oh, really, did you live here? Oh, is that what you drove? And blah, blah, blah. And he just kept rambling on. And we allowed him to do that because, I mean, I was eager to stay there 3-4 hours if this guy wanted to talk. And not until later when we kind of like, well, now we're getting to the goods that he kind of like backed off a little bit. But yeah, usually the guys that I've encountered, I interrogated, well, what do you want to know this for?
Yeah.
He never asked that. You know, I think he was just, he was okay with the fact that we were just BSing with him and, you know, and Sue was there next to me and maybe the fact that he just didn't want to be where he was at the cell, you know, I mean, it's probably boring in there and cold. And so that maybe was a factor, but I think the biggest factor is just that he had a big ego. And it was obvious once he started talking to us. And yeah, he just rambled on and on and on and gave us all the stuff that we needed.
Let me play a couple key moments from this part of the interview. Little reveals that he went to prison in 1984 for two assaults on women down in San Diego. We will talk about that case in a later episode. But for now, listen to what he says about getting out of prison on that case.
I got locked up in 84. I didn't get out in 87.
From the San Diego rap?
Yeah.
Okay, and then you went to L.A.?
I went to L.A. Uh-huh. Gene had a place there.
Okay.
After I was out, I got out in February, I think it was. Uh-huh. Which he died in September. So me and Barbara went back to Miami.
Little just placed himself in Los Angeles from February to September of 1987. It may not have seemed important during this interview, but later, his own words here would help tie him to a murder in L.A. in 1987. We'll be talking about that case later as well. Here's another key part of the interview.
So it's safe to say that your stay in L.A. during all this time was like 1987 to 90, maybe?
I stayed from 89. I stayed there about about a year.
With his own words, Little has just placed himself in L.A. at the time of the murders of Audrey Nelson and Guadalupe Apodaca. At another point in the interview, Little even ties himself unintentionally to a murder in Florida in 1982. This was a case where he was charged, but then at a trial he was acquitted. He said back then he didn't do it and didn't even know the victim. He even produced an alibi witness at trial. But talking to Amador and Antonucci here, he let slip that he did know the woman and was with her.
We had been through Gainesville, Florida. And they tried to get the girl down there. They tried to get me for killing a girl down there.
In Gainesville?
In Gainesville, Florida. And they charged me for taking her, picking her up in this bar. And then I had to go to trial on it.
Was she a prostitute?
Yeah, her name was Patricia Mouse.
Mr. Little, I got to say, you got a good memory.
I know.
Yeah, I remember all my ladies I've
been
with.
Yeah, you've been around.
Did you pick up on that? This was a murder rap he beat back in 1982, but he recalls the victim's name and then says he remembers all the names of the women he's been around. That wasn't what he said back then at trial when he denied knowing the victim. And see, all it took was a stroke of his ego, praise from the LA detectives regarding his ability to recall the names of the people in his life. At another point in the interview, Little is apparently so comfortable with the two detectives that he even brings up that he was once accused of being a serial killer. And when I heard that, I had to ask myself, was he tweaking them? Was he trying to get something over on them by hinting that he was a serial killer? Because remember, at this time, he thinks they're there maybe to talk about a drug case. He never really asked what it's about.
I got $1,600. I went and bought me a Oldsmobile. And I drove it. That's what I drove on back up in Ohio with.
Ohio.
Yeah.
When you drive these places, like you're driving to Ohio at that time, I mean, do you stop and hang out for weeks at a time in different towns and stuff? You know, knowing that you're really visiting, you're just checking out different places and towns and stuff, right? Driving through?
Is I go to towns that me and Gene used to go sell clothes to folks, man. Mm-hmm. And what I do, I go around where the dope house is, across there in the ghetto, and stay there, hang around on there, sell clothes, and smoke dope.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you take your time getting to wherever you're going and going to these different places or whatever. Mm-hmm. Not just driving straight through, right?
No.
But you just, like you said, you went wherever you had easy access to dope. Mm-hmm. Dope and maybe a girl or two.
Yeah.
Okay, so did you ever get arrested after that for anything more than or serious? Did you did some more time?
Only one serious charge I had that
San Diego one you told us about.
In Mississippi down there, I got arrested down there, and they tried to get me for raping this bro down there in Mississippi, and they tried to say that I was a serial killer. They tried to get me down there in Kingsville.
Who said that?
Mississippi.
So, law enforcement in Mississippi accused you of that?
They claim that the brothers that I was over with in the village that had got killed, and Pimple, somebody killed him.
Right.
But they couldn't put it, they tried to put it on me because I was down there too.
Right.
Once Amador and Antonucci had Little locked into a roadmap that included locations, times, and vehicles, the two detectives moved in for the kill, so to speak, and the interview with the cooperating Sam Little completely changed tone when the two detectives brought up the 1989 murders of the two women in Los Angeles. Where minutes earlier Little was easily recalling names and places, his memory suddenly started to fade and he was denying things he had just said minutes earlier.
Because I just be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right, right. That happens sometimes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's my life story. Anything else you want to know?
Yeah, I got a... Mr. Little, we're hoping you help us out here. During your travels in L.A., you say in 89, 88, 90, I mean, you told us you hung around prostitutes and stuff like that.
I hung around everybody.
Yeah. In 89, I know it's going to be tough. Do you remember ever seeing this woman here? Her name is Apodaca.
I don't know about her.
You never seen her before?
No, I don't think so.
Guadalupe. Her name is Guadalupe Apodaca.
Well, she's Mexican?
Yeah.
No.
Never seen her ever before.
Nope.
Okay. And you got a pretty good memory, too.
Yeah,
Why should I remember seeing her?
Let me see.
How about this woman here? Audrey Nelson.
Is she a white girl or black?
She was white. Give me a lot about it. I don't know, say 40s maybe.
No.
You ever seen these women? The reason I'm asking, or we're asking, they were prostitutes in the L.A. area in 1989, and they were found dead.
Well, I don't know about them.
No?
And... 1989.
89. In the L.A. area, they were found dead.
I don't even know if I was there in 89, was it?
I'm sorry?
I don't think I was even in Los Angeles in 89, was it? 88.
Well, you mentioned earlier you were, so that's why.
88. The next year is 89, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then 90. I was in prison in 80.
So you might have been in prison?
Wait a minute. 80 what, 9?
Yeah, 1989.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what year? I mean, what month?
I'd have to check.
I don't know him anyway, but you check and find out.
Yeah, but you say you don't know.
No, I ain't seen him.
When you got arrested for this offense in San Diego, and what was the other serious one you mentioned you got arrested for?
Pascagoula, Mississippi, uh-huh. And Gainesville, Florida.
Right. Did they ever take a swab or something for DNA? When was that? San Diego or the other one?
San Diego, Los Angeles, and other.
Do you know anything about DNA? Why they do that?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's the DNA. It's just for your DNA.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the reason we're asking is we work cold case homicide, LAPD, and we're working these two cases. I don't know. You said you hung around prostitutes and you partied and stuff.
You found some DA of mine on them?
I'm sorry?
You found some DA of mine on one of those people there?
Well, there's a possibility, yeah.
You better check again. You checked already?
Yeah, we checked.
Man, I ain't seen these two girls there, boy.
Take a good look at them. I don't know what you really have. You had any relationships with these girls?
Are they dead or living?
They're dead. They've been dead since 1989. We were cold case homicides. So that's why I came to just kind of ask you for your help.
I can't remember seeing them.
No? Because I'm going to be straight out with you.
Yeah.
Your DNA was found on both these girls.
I don't know how. If it's found there, then we just had to go to work on it.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we came.
My DNA was found on these girls.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is what? A white girl?
A white girl.
In
1989. Where at? In the L.A. area.
In the L.A. area? Mm-hmm. What part of the L.A. area?
Can you bring me those books?
Was it on?
It's my damn
email.
It's,
Man, I ain't
got. Oh, okay.
Man, y'all trying to pin something on me, man.
No, I'm not. I mean, I'm just...
I ain't never seen that. I know I ain't seen
that. Yeah, I mean, there might be an explanation you might give me. I don't know. I mean, you say you hung around prostitutes, and, you know, they happened to be prostitutes, and they were...
And my DA is on.
Yes, sir.
I know. I can't remember. No. I never seen this bro, huh? And I know I ain't never seen that one.
Mm-hmm. What you just heard was the key get of the whole interview. Remember when the DA told Detective Roberts she needed to make the case better? The concern was that because these victims were prostitutes, a suspect could use that as an explanation for his DNA being on their bodies. He could claim he had engaged the women in prostitution, but that he didn't kill them. But Sam Little just said the wrong thing.
He repeatedly denied knowing either of the women. Amador and Antonucci knew they had just locked him into a story. It would be hard for him to change later.
I knew he was going to say no, and I wanted him to say no if he was not going to make a confession, because we know that we had DNA evidence on the guy from the evidence taken from these two women. So if he would have said, yeah, you know what, I had sex with him, but I didn't kill him, now we got a little problem. So it was almost better for him even just to deny that he knew these women, because we had them on DNA, and that was something that we looked at. I knew he was going to say no, and I wanted him to say no.
Now, understanding that a murder net was dropping around him, Little threw more denials at the detectives. They even showed him photos of the victims and gave him a chance to correct his story about not knowing them. But again, he said the wrong thing, denying knowing them and somehow clinging to the idea, or maybe the hope, that the DNA match was wrong.
Okay, this is the white girl, Audrey.
This is her?
Yeah, she was found, let's see here. She was found on 7th Street.
That's downtown.
Yeah. I mean, you told us that you used to
frequent in an alley on 7th.
Doesn't say if it was an alley. And you know 7th Street, you've been to 7th
yeah.
Street.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to 8th Street. Third.
And you know what happens on 7th Street. There's dope, there's prostitute. Yeah, so somewhere it was, the address was, it was a 2,000 block of 7th Street, East 7th Street.
200, yeah. What would that be?
Right around Mateo and 7th.
Mateo.
Skid Row.
Mateo.
Yeah, Mateo Street and 7th Street. There's shelters there.
Yeah,
San Mission.
Yeah, I'll be in the Mission.
Well, they found her right around there.
Well, I hated the time her around. I ain't had nothing to do with her.
Is it possible you might have sex with her?
No, I knew I had no sex with her.
Little tried to further bolster his denial by telling the detectives he was impotent and couldn't have left DNA on the victims. He then asked for a lawyer.
The only thing I'm saying is, y'all done brought these pictures of a strange two women up here. I'm talking about my DNA on them
right.
In 1989. So I'm saying it ain't. So all you got to do, put your charges on me and get me a lawyer.
Okay.
I'm not going to say no more.
Okay, that's okay.
All right, Mr. Little, well, thanks for your cooperation. Good luck to you, sir.
And that was it. The interview was over. Sam Little was returning to his cell there in Louisville, and Antonucci and Amador were heading back to L.A. Amador said they were happy with what they had gotten on tape.
Once we confronted him with the fact, okay, you know what, we got your DNA in this, on these two crime scenes, and he just shut down at that point.
Yeah.
He did what I was expecting him to do, is just shut down and not want to talk to us about that anymore. But it was a little too late, because he opened up about everything else we wanted him to. So that was really good.
Detective Roberts in Los Angeles agreed.
It was definitely information that helped us in the investigation as far as to what cars he drove during the years we were looking at him, and specifically where he was during certain time periods, especially during the 80s, what state he was in. He admitted that he was in Los Angeles during the times of our murders, which was extremely beneficial. So yeah, we would, Rod and I would go back and forth with what Sam sort of told him. And although it wasn't an all out confession, we did get some. It was a positive interview in the fact that they were able to draw out some information from him that helped us down the line with the investigation.
At the time of the interview, Amador and Antonucci, of course, didn't know what was to come. They knew they were talking to a killer, but not someone who would later admit to committing 93 murders. I asked Amador if he had any sense of what this man had been capable of, whether he saw cunning and evil in Sam Little's eyes.
You know what? When I first laid eyes on him, he had that look. He just had that look. I don't know if it's evil look. As I got to talk to him, he was a con artist. He was a shyster, a scam artist who preyed on women. And preyed on weak women, a big ego. He wasn't sophisticated at all. I don't think. I think he was just lucky all these years. And but I got a sense that this guy, maybe as a childhood past, had a very tough childhood past. Maybe got abused. Didn't have a stable life as a kid, and something went wrong with women in his life, where he had to prey and got satisfaction on this, on killing women, weak women, you know, defenseless women, who were easy to lure. What that is, I don't know, because we didn't get to talk to him in depth about that. I'm not a psychologist, but he had a little evil in him. But like I said, if you were to see this guy in the street, you would think he's a construction worker or just a, you know, everyday joke kind of guy. But as you spoke to him, he was egotistical. There's no doubt about that. And there was just a look in his eye of, yes, evil. But, yeah, it's, and I've dealt with guys like this in the past, maybe to not extent, but he could never, he's the type of guy that would never own his own faults. You know, it's not me, or I didn't do that, or, you know, that's the kind of guy that I think he was. Wouldn't take blame for his own doings. He had to blame it on somebody else. And there was always a reason why he did what he did. That's kind of like the sense I got from this guy. And I think he was just one of these guys that escaped the system and got lucky until, you know, we broke it on this case with the DNA evidence that we had on him. So he couldn't deny that. And so we were in a way lucky as well.
I'm Michael Connelly, and you have been listening to Murder Book. We'll continue the story next week when Detective Roberts and her colleagues connect more of the dots and a fuller picture of Sam Little as a brutal predator emerges. I want to thank our listeners, our sponsors, and our consultants. Murder Book is produced and edited by Terrell Lee Langford. Music is provided by Grace Kelly, including our theme song, By the Grave. Post-production services are provided by Authentic, and Emma Kikuchi is post-production supervisor. Jane Davis is in charge of our social media, and if you want to see photos and other material from the case, go to murderbookpodcast.com. Remember, subscribe to the podcast at applepodcasts.com/murderbook if you want to be alerted to new episodes and other announcements. And if you have a friend who likes true crime podcasts, make sure you tell them about this one. Finally, leave us a rating and a review at Apple Podcasts. This is Michael Connelly saying thanks for listening.